genetically engineered.
Now the Monster Mash.
The Monster Mash.
And it's a graveyard smash.
It's now the mash.
It's got horn and flash.
It's now the mash.
It's now the Monster Mash. Now everything's cool. Drax a part of the band. And my Monster Mash is the hit of the land. For you, the living, this mash was meant to. When you get to my door, tell them what it said.
Then you can mash.
Then you can Monster Mash.
The Monster Mash.
And you, my graveyard smash.
Then you can mash.
You'll catch on in a flash.
Then you can mash.
Then you can Monster Mash.
The views expressed on Exopolitics Radio with Alfred Weber are the views of Alfred Weber and not specifically those of our on-air affiliates or our sponsors.
Welcome back. This is Exopolitics Radio, a weekly magazine format public affairs program on Exopolitics, the new political science of outer space.
You are about to embark on an exciting adventure, one that could change your life when you join us on the Robert Miles Show. On this show, you will discover new ideas, new concepts, startling ideas that might shock your previous beliefs, and challenge your convictions of how things are, or perhaps how you believe them to be. The Robert Miles Show is a voyage of self-discovery, hearing things that might seem unimaginable or even impossible to conceive. Join us here every Monday night from 7 to 9 p.m. to stretch your mind and shatter your illusions. We now turn you over to your host, Robert Miles.
Well, good evening and welcome to the Robert Miles Show. We got a great show lined up tonight, and I want to thank you all for joining us. Our guest tonight is Tom Morey, and Tom Morey is a unique individual with exceptional insights, interests,
and talents.
He's a recognized authority on water sports, that's for sure. And he is the inventor of the Morey Boogie. And Tom has brought joy and happiness and fun to millions of people. Welcome, Tom Morey. Welcome to the Robert Miles Show.
Hey, it's great
to be with you.
And what many of us are calling the worst economic times of our lives.
20 years.
President Obama made promises during his campaign. And now, we wait to see how many of them
will
make good.
It's a new show, Tom, and what we're trying to do is we're trying to bring to the people of the world some of the unique insights and interests of not only people that are interested in economics and politics, but also in energy and religions. And you're an interesting guy because you've got a philosophy of living life as a surfer. Why don't you tell our audience a little bit about yourself and what that philosophy means to you?
And yet, it profoundly affected generations as they coped with the memory of it.
Robert, I'm 75 years old.
One of my grandfathers lost his farm during the Depression, as did many other people. I grew up with a sober memory of that event immortalized in the auction poster from when it, along with his household goods,
I was born in Detroit, Michigan.
Hunger wasn't as usual then, nor were homeless people. Many children were being abandoned in orphanages or to the streets. Alcohol and drug use were rampant, yes, that's correct, legal or not. alcohol and drug use is something that started off as the flower children of the 60s.
During World War II, my dad...
We had people struggling to pay taxes, rent, other bills. Mortgages were being defaulted on, causing people to lose homes and property.
Banks were closing. Businesses
closed. Small businesses were hard hit to survive. Credit was impossible to obtain.
Which included surfing.
There were many suicides as people were unable to face the future or the money that they lost.
Radio station coming out of Tijuana.
Does that sound familiar?
I
could be talking about the issues of today now.
Panic
over the economy isn't far off from the things people talk. The FDIC recently raised the amount of insurance covering individual deposits at banks to prevent panic over the bank closure from having a ripple effect. As people search their homes out of banks. Businesses are laying off workers, yet some are simply not filling vacancies that they normally would fill. People aren't spending money, whether they have it available or not, because of the fears of what the future is going to bring. Chains are closing less protective stores in hopes of preserving their other stores. Every day,
Association,
you hear about more people who have been laid off.
Done first professional surfing contest.
I'm just like everyone else. I have a job to every morning.
Have tended towards.
It's a small business.
Flying
standalone one. We depend on people having disposable income for so-called luxuries such as pets and travel.
And the influence of shape.
I've worked there nearly 6 years.
The
business is well over a decade old. Statistically, it's the sort of business that's unlikely to fail. And yet, each week. I'm wondering,
really
will I get the bad news this week? Will I have a job next month? I have friends who have been laid off from their jobs, and other friends who have seen co-workers getting laid off and having escaped that axe themselves for now. But who will be next? The Gulf Coast has a better economy than most areas, but for how long? What kinds of jobs will be available? Will I be able to find a job again if I was to lose this one? Job hunting is a traumatic, stress-filled occupation with no pay. To get paid, you have to find that elusive employment. Each time you apply, your ego is exposed to anyone that wants to take your potshot at it, as you're suddenly forced into the position of selling yourself as the second employee for that job. In the Great Depression, despite the lack of funds for many things, one thing that remained very popular was going to the movies. In the dark theater, you can escape the mundane struggle of life as you immerse yourself in romances or adventure or someone else's struggles. Radio, books, and magazines were also popular pastimes, satisfying that urge for escapism.
The electromagnetic workings.
Now, granted, radio programs of the day were not quite like the one you're listening to tonight.
I'm married.
They all have a computer and the internet, and it's starting for entertainment.
Today,
we have an access to millions of avenues for escaping our problems, and one available yet then, from the ability to stay right at home and download a movie, to do that same evening, ordering a pizza.
Jolly,
but
who,
can possibly imagine
the get
on the internet,
in
music, whatever.
Linda,
we have podcast programs on demand on almost every topic imaginable.
So that's
satellite radio stations.
The
average home has hundreds of television
Most people
stations.
Know about
Nothing
the Maury
Boogie.
Nothing
television for few and far between.
You know,
black and white and filled with mysterious
factitudes,
seems inclined all sorts
of
phenomena.
You sent us some of your
phenomena.
Music, and Sherry,
magical function.
Have you got some
of
Tom's music there?
In that huge
are you able to play a little piece of Tom's music for us?
Relegated to the world of
I'll be able to do that. I just have to queue it up
here. Homes in
okay. Well, Tom, you're actually playing with a group now, there locally. But
okay.
I'm playing with the guys that are in this area.
Let alone from the computer in our office
music
at home.
Music is kind of
keyboard readers are still a bit expensive,
kind of
but are becoming much more common every day. I have about a half dozen magazine subscriptions myself that are strictly electronically delivered. Although they are also available in print format. I like the electronic format. I can keep those magazines forever without my destructo bleeding and to shred it. I'll confess, I'm one of those weird people that will say, I remember seeing a recipe for cooking parsnips with chili and wild grapes that serve with rosemary roasted nutria that appeared a few years ago in Magazine X.
It's gone into
a normal stack of magazines, I'd be searching for days trying to find the exact issue. so publications in electronic form.
I play with the local
and for other sorts of books, I have to admit, I rather enjoy using the electronic form of the book.
Then
I started to publish two novels in the ebook format, and we were fortunate enough to appear in our program last year to talk about our first one.
So we get
that
together,
first book has now also been published in a paperback, and tonight one lucky listener can win a copy of it, which Elizabeth A. Cox will then put in the mail
on Tuesday night
for that listener.
We've been a coffee
now, if you would like to win that copy of A Ghost of a Chance,
and it's kind of like church, it's for fun.
To make it fair, it's available to the first person who emails me or texts me with a question in the virtual auditorium, or raises their hand in the virtual auditorium and asks a question. To email me, send it to Gia, G-I-A, at exogenynetwork.com. exogenynetwork.com. Now, for podcast audience, we listen to the program long after this program first airs.
You were working on the boogie board
for the entire month of February.
You had this idea that you wanted to get a way down surfboard, a flexible surfboard.
How you can win it.
And
there's two ways to enter me.
Yeah, and I remember that the boogie went through a lot of changes.
GIA at Exogeny.
Tell us a little bit about
this. Network.
Tell us a bit about the evolution of that board and how it came to be a short board and made
it. And the winner will randomly be drawn from those.
When I was 10, 12, 13 years old, I rented out surf mats in the town of Laguna Beach, and they were like a truncated an air mattress that was used in the water. You'd blow them up and go out there and put around, and we'd try and stand up on them, and we'd ride waves on our knees and so forth. And they were fun, but they were not the right shape. And then someplace along the line, somebody came out with these little styrene bead boards that had a shape that meant nothing, and the boards fell apart, but they only cost $3. And so they became kind of popular, and you'd see broken boards everywhere. And one day I came across some materials that I had seen as a composite material vendor, and these materials were polyethylene foam, which is a flexible closed-cell material that's used for packing. And it comes in logs, and you see them maybe in your drugstores, even today, as a fanoodle, as a beach toy, just a colored piece of foam that's the diameter, a little greater than a diameter greater than a beer can. You know. Well, I had come across some logs of that material that had been bound together in a solid surf mat. And I tried it out. It worked really good, and it didn't leak any water. I thought, that's a great material for something, but the shape is wrong. And years later, I was in Hawaii, and my surfboard had broken. My wife, Masha, was pregnant with our first son. And I was a part-time writer for Surfer Magazine and was designing a board for big waves. And the big deal then would be that we were going to try and ride Kaiena Point, which would get 30, 40 feet. It was reported. Of course, nobody ever said birds eye 30 or 40 feet because the sizes that were acceptable to mention were 20 feet, maybe 25 feet, but nobody had even heard of a wave that big, 30 feet, 35 feet. Except there was this place, Kaiena Point, that was supposed to maybe have waves like that. So with that in mind, I was building an epoxy fiberglass bottom, which had some special air lubricated contours, and the top I had lofted out of this polyethylene foam, which I'd found the source of, and it was in my garage on a little surf point there on the big island of Hawaii, a little place called Hanos. And boy, I was close to out of money, and this board that I had made with that flexible foam on top and this hard bottom had structural problems and broke couple of times and over a period of about 6 months. And finally, the second time I broke, I was real discouraged, but I needed something to surf because the waves came up. I had extra foam in the garage, so I commandeered an iron such as you use to iron clothes. And I borrowed an electric carving knife And I fished a few pages of the Honolulu Advertiser, actually the July 5th, 1971 Honolulu Advertiser. I fished out of a trash can. And I tore off a piece of this paper and put it on the corner of some of this foam that I had left over from my project, heated up the iron, and kind of squashed and rubbed the foam into a different shape, but without the foam sticking to the iron because the paper vented the gases and also kept the gooey plastic from collecting to the iron. And so I found I could shape that. So using a carving knife, I cut out the first board. I didn't know what to call it or how to shape it exactly, except that I wanted to make it square on the front so I could hold on to it. And I knew that I needed to hold on to a flexible piece of material so that it wouldn't bend under me.
PC investors, my son loves pizza, but this was a first. Grease on his back. I totally missed it. Another shirt ruined.
Good thing the expertise of Spray Wash combined with the power of Resolve in our new in wash stain remover.
Only Resolve has stain seekers.
Just treat the stains you see and add to the wash for the ones you missed.
A bit of vacuum on the inside rail. Of course, this was all ironed newspaper print, and I would iron over the newspaper and then pull the paper off, and the print would transfer.
The stain seekers will find, penetrate, and lift away the toughest stains.
And that's how we, years later, found out that it was made on July 7th, 1971, because it was a July 5th newspaper, and it was a July 5th newspaper, and I figured it took probably a couple of days for that to release the trash and for me to put this thing together.
Trust Resolve. Forget
July 7th, 1971 is the official date of the first board, which I later called a boogie board. Well, I first called it a machine because I used my side navel.
Eva Mendez, Paris Hilton, Jessica Biel, and supermodel Alessandra Ambrosio have all been spotted. Here are a few tips to help you incorporate this trend into your wardrobe. First, keep it simple. Do not mix prints and remember to take your inspiration directly from the animals where this trend was originated. If your style is classy and elegant, simply accessorize with safari decor. This tone-on-tone look is in style without saying over the top. Or for a hip and stylish look, you can wear your basic jean and tank top and add a hat.
Which you're in the water. This allowed you the surface of the water, and it undulated, it snaked along. I was going to put that name together with my own name, Maury, and make something called a Maury eel and do all this kind of stuff. I tried the name out on a few people, however, and they said they didn't really like snakes, and somebody said those snakes are from the devil, so.
With the money you invest in clothes, why risk they'll end up faded or stretched? Try Wool Light Complete.
It's for all your clothes.
Because it has the right balance of cleaning and care.
And say goodbye to fading,
shrinking, and stretching. Wool Light Complete keeps all your clothes.
Kind of suction on the inside that would hold me to the wave, but also I could surf in waters that were only an inch deep, where other guys were coming out of the water because their rudders, those little skags in the back, would be dragging and hitting the rocks. My board skimmed right over that. I could also run and skim into the water. So I knew I really had something, and Marsh and I fixed up a car for a guy, and he got half the money, and he loaned us the other half, and then somebody else, a wonderful soul that's still there on the Big Island, Jack Spock, was the first to believe in me and believe in his name. He loaned me $200. So we raised some money, came to the mainland, developed a manufacturing process, and bootstrapped ourselves up into a multi-million dollar business, which I later sold.
Well,
that's a little about the boogie board.
Well, it was an exciting adventure for you. Being a person like you are, you persisted. And you kept perfecting it. I remember when you were actually doing it as a kit to start with, and I know you read an ad in Surfer Magazine, and you got response, and you just kept going, buddy.
I just kept on.
Yeah.
Just keep on keeping on.
Yeah. And you found a good partner in Jermaine Faber, and he was knife expert, and Jim helped you a lot too, didn't he?
Jim was quite instrumental in the development of the manufacturing process. He is a carpenter. He'd been a carpenter, and he just loved knives. And he would find like a file or something, and go home and grind it into a knife and drink a lot of coffee with a lot of sugar in it, either at any time of day, and smoking 3-4 packs of cigarettes a day, making knives.
Yeah.
And he was a neighbor. People said, you ought to meet this guy. I did, and we got together. He always carried a knife with him, and whereas I was in the garage sawing these boards out with a saber saw, he said, let me see that foam a minute. And he pulled a knife out of his pocket, out of his little scabbard, and just sliced off a bit of this foam, just like butter. And my eyes popped.
Yeah.
The idea that we could cut these things with knives. So we built some little jigs using Marsh's kitchen table and some devices that held the knives while you push them along. Mm-hmm. We developed a manufacturing process that would cut out, well, at its peak, we were making 1,000 boogie boards a day using knives and a hot air welder that we also developed that was based on the use of heating lamps and the principle of a window. How a window slides up and down in its window frame and it's in the sashing. We built our first machine based on that, Jim did. And I had read the book, Up the Organization by the guy, Ryder Davis, and in that book he says, you want geniuses? They're in your neighborhood, just look around. Which I did, and sure enough, there they were, and I had one couple of salespeople, and I had this gal that lives here, Patty Serrano, who actually has an internet program, maybe not too much different than your own, Bob.
I'll be darned.
Who was the promoter of our competition. And so we went from selling a couple of thousand in the first year to 4,000 or 5,000 the next year, and then 30,000 and 80,000.
Wow.
Going like that. And eventually it was bought out by a company called Costco, and they took it further. And then, gee whiz, it's been a long time, 40-something years. And there's maybe 20 or 50 million people out there that ride boogie boards in all countries that have ocean. You know, Spain, France, New Zealand, Australia, and where they have rivers, they're a great thing to go down the river. In fact, when we were visiting you up there in Klamath River, was it? Where you were gold mining?
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
yeah, we've had a lot of fun together over the years. You know, that's the thing about Tom Morey. Tom Morey has a lot of depth to him. He's a lot more than just an inventor, aren't you, Tom? You're a lot more than just a musician as well. You've got a lot of insights into the whole ancient history of the Earth. You've followed the energy curve. Tell us a little bit about your experiences with magnets. I know that you're fascinated by them, and you've taken it to a very high level.
Well, I believe in something that you know about. I believe in sailing. Sailing is such a clever invention. And how many centuries did they go on the water and paddle before they figured out the sail, and then figured out the rudder and the keel, so that without paddling, you could sail using tact and wisdom anywhere you wanted. There's free energy. There's a collection of free energy. And with electricity and with magnets, we just haven't figured out how to shape the sail. We don't know how to tap this electricity and get it for nothing directly from the magnetic field and the electrical interrelationship between the various ever-changing poles on the planet, ever-changing electrical poles, except that during the early days of the telegraphs were powered by a manner I do not understand, but by tapping the electrical currents that are natural and travel underground. And Benjamin Franklin or Thomas Edison, one of those guys, was the first to build a little electric motor that worked on the electrical potential difference between the elevation of, say, 3 feet and 6 feet. There's an electrical energy, a potential drop just in that short distance, enough to make a motor, a small motor, run. Now, we have seen free energy examples all our lives, really. When you've gone to Hoover Dam and watched the water cascade over the falls and the turbines and generate electricity, why, really, that's free energy. Although you got to pay to get it set up, and you got to pay middlemen to maintain it, and people who have built the wiring from there to your house and all that stuff. So, you know, basically, it's free. We also can see free energy, which is a problem on the rails of trains. For railroads, where the track runs north and south, such as it does right here by my house, where the train is crossing, is causing an electrical cross between the two rails at one position, and if you then cross from rail to rail down a distance, you'll have you'll get a shock, you'll get electrical flow, and that's because these tracks are traveling through the Earth's permanent magnetic field, which is rather dense when you quantify it, and it's traveling at a pretty high rate. So there's free energy there. This magnetic field is quite a phenomena that we don't really have on our consciousness. We check the weather, some check sunspots, you know, we check the temperature, we check the winds within the weather. But this planet's turning 25,000 miles at the equator every 24 hours. And that means that if you're a guy standing there on the beach in Panama, we'll say, or Ecuador, I guess, you're going 1,042 miles an hour. Now, it doesn't seem like that. Maybe it's a calm day and the ocean's a pale blue and the sun seems to be standing still, or the moon and the stars are up there. But nevertheless, you're going faster than you've ever seen anything go. Maybe when you're in an airplane at 600 miles an hour, you pass another airplane that's going 600 miles an hour. You'd see that, you know, you see 1,200 miles an hour. But right now, where you are in North America, you're going at least 700 and maybe 1,000 miles an hour. And you're cutting through a magnetic field that is as dense as, it's anywhere that you are, it is 1/100th as dense as a typical refrigerator magnet. Now, that may not seem like much, but a volume that would hold 100 refrigerator magnets is no greater than, say, a large grapefruit or a small cantaloupe. And if you were to quantify the volume of your body, you'd see that it occupies maybe 15 or maybe 30 cantaloupes. So all the time that you're maybe sitting or walking, it's as though you are dealing with the electromagnetic interfacing of 20, 30, 40 refrigerator magnets, which again don't seem much, but they're there all the time. And they're also there influencing our transportation, but we don't pay much attention to it. Electricity builds up on airplanes. Well, it's attributed to the fact that the airplane is moving through the atmosphere and there's friction. But it's also moving through this magnetic field, as are the trains and the cars, as is the ocean and the rivers and the lakes, and all living things and all matter. Now, in the religions of the past, the believer usually turns to the east and faces the east. The yoga faces the east, and there's reasons that are given that each give because the founder came from there, we'll say. But another aspect of it is that if, when you're sleeping, for example, if you're facing, if your head and feet are aligned east-west, while you're cutting through these magnetic fields, the magnetic field, with the least possible resistance, other than going sideways through it or in any kind of skewed position. I think in terms of the course of pushing through a wave, if I'm out there in the water and I'm paddling out and there's a wave coming, or even swimming towards it, I'm going to make myself as small and as narrow to the wave's energy as I possibly can. Just a few nights ago, we switched over to, from our, I got my compass out and I found that our bed was aligned so that we were, I hadn't been comfortable for years in this bed. And we were aligned at 37 degrees off of north. So I swung around and got Marcia to come around and line up with me. And we lined up east and west. And although you may think it's a rather subjective test, man, we slept like logs.
Wow.
Now, previously I had also done experiments with what I call a dreamscape. I have very vivid dreams, and I have found that I dream, I like the way my dreams are and the entities that I find in them when I'm facing, when my head's to the west. I also like the east and the north. I don't like the south, like it when my house hits the south very much. And I think that's an area that could be explored and will be explored in greater depth in the future, is the effects of our positions, along with, of course, our foods and the materials that are touching us and the amount of insulation that we have above us and to our sides and below us. But also just the positions as well as the thoughts that we have and how they affect our dreams and the interrelationship of those dreams and what we call here reality.
Interesting. Interesting stuff, Tom. Tom, one of the things that many people would be interested in would be during the time you worked for Boeing in the later part of your career, you made some comments about the vastness of Boeing and some of the things you observed while you were there. You even submitted a design for an aircraft. Tell us about...
I was down on my luck living in Hawaii back in the 80s where interest rates had gotten quite high. And although I had money and I had two houses, I didn't have any income because I didn't have a job. And then I found that I was having difficulty selling one of the houses. To make a long story short, I needed a job. So I came to the mainland and I ended up with a position at Boeing Aircraft in their commercial division out in Renton. And I worked there for 3 years, and I worked in composite R&D. Now, what that was about is that at the time, about 11% of Boeing Aircraft were made of composite materials, that is, stuff like epoxy fiberglass or carbon fiber epoxy or the like, or PEEK, or some of these other higher temperature materials. But the main structures, the primary structures, the fuselage and the wings, not the ailerons and not the flaps, and the main rudder and the main vertical and horizontal stabilizers, these were all made out of aluminum. And so I was in a group with 65 engineers, and we would be given the designs that were proposed and then given the task of developing a manufacturing process, the tooling and the proper materials and the gauge thicknesses and all that for making these parts a reality. And we would build experimental parts and write up papers, take pictures, and then run them through management. And they would, every once in a while, somebody would celebrate that one of their parts had replaced an aluminum part on an airplane. But I found out that Boeing is a very conservative company, and rightly so, because they, my gosh, they produce the most sophisticated, the most reliable thing on the planet. I mean, you might be a designer or a builder of office buildings, but they they just have to stand there, and then others fill them in with the electronics and an airplane. It cannot fall out of the sky, man. You can't lose many, you know?
Yeah.
And that has to be really a foolproof, high-tech device, and it has to sell for a decent price. And it's so clever, and there's so much going on. You know, when you're in the plane and you look out the window and there's that engine, and it's making a little noise, and you realize it's got stuff in there turning 100,000 RPM, and materials that could, if they fly out, they're gonna puncture the motor and come through the hull and all this stuff. And yet, you make it to Hawaii, you make it to New York, and it goes on and on. And you watch the news day after day, year after year, and maybe there's miners trapped, and there's a flood, and this and that. These days, it is very seldom that there's a aircraft problem. So they were very cautious about changing over to composites, and rightly so, because after management tabled a major project for the 7J7, which was the construction of a primary structure, the vertical stabilizer, for years, for like 3 years, this program went on, and millions of dollars were spent to develop a proper manufacturing process for using carbon fiber to build that structure. And management at Boeing tabled it, canceled it, and stayed with their aluminum. And not too long after, there was a plane or two that were Airbus that had primary structures made out of composite materials that had failures. And anyhow, it was a very long, slow process. Everything at Boeing was very long, thorough, slow, redundant. It was like sailing in the Sargasso Sea. And there was a lot of hotshot guys that had tales about how things used to be. But they were there showing up at 7 o'clock with ketchup on their ties and putting along there in the Sargasso. However, Boeing got the job done, and Boeing makes reliable flying devices. And it is such a large company. At the time I was there, they would have sales. All work would be stopped for a few minutes, and there'd be an announcement on the PA, and they had just landed a $4 million sale of so many aircraft. You know, those aircraft add up at $50 million apiece or $100 million each. You know, you sell not so many. So you come up to $4 or $5 billion. And there was like 100,000 employees at all the different facilities and thousands of vendors. And I don't think that any manager in latter times has ever walked all the corridors in Boeing.
Interesting. Well, it's certainly a competitive world out there as far as the aircraft industry goes. And, of course, we're being challenged on every front by the introduction of China into the trade spectrum. Everywhere you go now, it's made in China or it's made outside the U.S. But I want to talk a little bit about your research that you did into the German technology back at the time when these flying devices were actually being flown. And as you know, I have a very strong interest. Many of the people in the audience have a very strong interest in the whole UFO field. So you've got a very specific point of view. Why don't you share that with our audience?
I'd be glad to. Like the rest of us, back in the 40s, I was born in 1935, and then in 1947, we heard a little about the Roswell thing, and in 55, there was a plane that chased a UFO, and it disappeared and all this stuff. And from early on, it made more sense to me that we are not alone in the universe, because that would mean that the chances that we're the only beings in the universe are, in an infinitely large universe, are one in infinity. or the chances that we're the most intelligent and the most advanced, again, one in infinity. So it's probable that we're not all that well advanced and that there are all kinds of other entities and civilizations. And so then that we might cite something from some other place that made sense to me. So I started following up on all the crank stories that I would hear and cutting out newspaper articles and all this and that. Well, someplace along the line, a really logical history of this came to my mind, probably early in the internet days when I started looking up. I got a book by a guy that says, talked about man-made UFOs, man-made flying devices. And so the history that I can reconstruct goes like this. Back in the day, Sikorsky and others were developing vertical takeoff craft. Sikorsky's name, of course, is best known as the man that made the helicopter and made helicopters a reality. However, the helicopter is a crude device. And again, another thought that I have that drives me all the time, Bob, is that whereas I used to think of these as modern times and our contemporaries being sophisticated and so forth, the fact is that these are really ancient times. You know, if we live another 50 years, we'll look back on this and we'll go, my God, that was crude back there.
Yeah.
The way they did this and the way they did that. I mean, they fly these airplanes on kerosene. Why should you hear an airplane flying that's 5 miles above you? Why should it be making that much noise? Why is the helicopter going and each blade is blowing air down onto its own fuselage? Why are these crude blades whacking, just 3 or 4 blades whacking away along in the air? And why is that thing got a limited speed because based on you can only make the blades turn so fast and the plane turn and the plane travel so fast? And that's only a couple hundred miles an hour total. And then the blade tips are reaching the speed of sound barriers and causing all kinds of problems. Why is it that the world's most popular game, I got a big kick out of this, I'm diverging a lot, I know, but the world's soccer matches a few months back. And finally, here's these two teams and all this roaring and the championship of all the teams that had played each other all the way up this ladder with all these well-dressed and well-muscled and highly athletic guys running around, kicking that ball. When the ball gets kicked out of bounds, somebody has to run way out there to get it and bring it back in. And this goes on for an hour or two. And here's the world championship, and the score is tied nothing to nothing. That the whole world would be involved in a sport like that is amazing to me, because it's not a really clever, although the moves are clever, it's just not, to me, it's just not a good sport. It's a great activity. But anyhow, going back to these early days of the helicopter, it doesn't make sense to make all that noise and to be as inefficient as the thing seems to be. So somebody back there thought, well, heck, let's just put more blades on it. In fact, instead of having tip loss, let's put a ring around there, a duct, and we'll spin 20, 30 blades and put the cargo in the center and put some feet on the bottom, and we'll use some motors and make this thing whirl around, and we'll get some lift from that. Let's make that. So the Germans made that, and I don't have the name in front of me. I'm not much on remembering the names. Meissner, Melzler, something like that. Your fans out there know who that is. And if you go Google images, if you go YouTube and you type in German UFO, German flying saucers, Nazi UFOs, Nazi saucers, you'll see all these pictures and all this stuff, and you read all this mishmash, which includes a lot of really great pictures, a lot of really wonderful concepts, and a great history. But I believe that these guys went from spinning multi-bladed craft and trying to make these things work. And another branch developed parallel to this, where some smart devil decided to not be so direct in trying to push air back and screw himself forward or screw himself up by having an air screw that's either horizontally or vertically mounted, and instead used an impeller, such as used on a vacuum cleaner. Now, an impeller is a kind of a fan that sucks the air to its front and spews it out the sides at right angles. A supercharger is an impeller. You can look up impellers under Google Images, and you can see what I'm talking about right away.
Sure.
And these guys, there's a site called Kawanda Thrust Experiment. Henry Kawanda was an amazing guy that built the first jet airplane. The Wright brothers flew in something like 1904. Henry Kawanda built the first jet-propelled airplane in 1907. It flew 50 or 100 feet or something, but it was a wooden plane, and the flames burned it up.
Wow.
But he came up with the idea, and they named the effect after him, of how a fluid sucks to a curved surface. You can see this if you go to your sink and dangle a spoon and let water under the water faucet, let water run down on it. The water will run on the round of that spoon and suck that spoon to itself. This is an important thing for us, we surfboard builders, to pay attention to, because we use the Kawanda effect in order to suck to the wave here, but not suck to the wave there and get it to go fast and all this stuff by having breakaway edges. You notice it when you try and pour fluid out of your cup of coffee into another cup, and that's big round edges, and then fluid runs all down the side and dribbles out the bottom. Or it used to be like that with syrup until somebody came up with a little sharp plastic edge so that you can pour your Aunt Jemima maple syrup onto your pancakes without spilling. So somebody back there in the German days came up with spinning a centrifugal impeller over the top of a curved bowl and found that they could get that bowl to lift. Now, you don't get a whole lot of lift, but if you turn that bowl sideways, you do get enough thrust to propel a vehicle. And you can see, if you again look at the Kawanda thrust experiment made by a wonderful gentleman that's in a wheelchair, and his associates in a European country, or maybe it's Russia, one of the European, anyhow, it's on YouTube, you'll see a couple of his experiments that prove this without a doubt. Independent of him, I had also come up with this thing and propelled a skateboard with one of these devices on the front, run by a little handheld, the motor from a little handheld vacuum cleaner. Well, then I came across a website that explained a great deal of it, and I can't remember the exact names of it, but I've sent it to you, and it's something like EVS-NAROD-RU. You'll come across it if you look up UFO engine, and somebody's made a video called UFO engine amazing, and in the back of that, on that video, on many of the shots of it, you see this other website, and then you can go to that and you get the author's actual drawings and some explanation. But in those drawings, he shows this centrifugal impeller not only blowing air over the top of the saucer, but also sucking air down into itself and then blowing it out horizontally into the underside of that bowl. And furthermore, air being sucked in and blown out over the overside of an interior bowl. Of course, this air is blown out over the bowl and then exits out the back, but also air being blown onto the underside of that secondary bowl and enclosed, and moisture is added. And that moisture air circulates in this latter bowl, in this latter forest, donut shape, in a toroidal manner, like a hurricane or a tornado, a toroidal. There must be some term for whatever that is, whatever that, how that air is moving. And that air is churning around with the moisture, and it develops electricity, a negative charge, just like it does out here in the sky when the clouds, there's turbulence up there and there's moisture, and you see it get darker and darker, and then lightning comes, and then it rains and dumps the moisture. Inside this, it's becoming a negative electrical storm, and the outside bottom of this ship is becoming positively charged. And I believe that what went on with these guys that were experimenting back there with conventional motors, they were using conventional electrical motors, except for two guys, Hans Kohler, who was using, he had developed a way to tap the electricity from magnets in a limited manner. And you can look up the Kohler device, C-O-L-O-R. And also Victor Schauberger, who was figuring out how and built some very powerful experiments on how to develop the energy latent in water and how to extract that electricity and utilize it. And his craft, his designs are fantastic. So between Kohler and Schauberger and these other guys that were experimenting and then building using slave labor and building these devices and getting them funded by the Nazis, they made terrific progress and probably built a lot of actual flying devices that we around here are calling UFOs. Now, those one of the steps in there that I appreciate as an inventor is about prototype building. And I believe that these guys would build something and then try it out. They would not build it, paint it, and then try it out. They would not paint it to make it look good, and therefore they also didn't insulate it from the electrical activities that occur as air is passed at high speeds across metal. Electricity is developed, and these electrical side effects were probably finally recognized by somebody, and some measurements were made, and somewhere along the line, they found that the electrical charge can develop propulsion. Now, Brown and Byfield, who was another in the Brown-Byfield experiment, found that a capacitor that's hanging straight on like threads from the support above, from the ceiling, if you charge that capacitor, it will hang crooked. And it hangs crooked, supposedly, even in a vacuum, which is a very interesting fact. And it hangs with itself, having lifted itself towards the positive terminal. Now, I'm probably getting my facts crisscrossed and so forth, but that's the point of this interview. This is for us all to realize that there's a great deal that we can do. It's not all hocus pocus. It's not about aliens. It might be aliens' influence, but that we here on this planet are never, as individuals paying taxpayers, are never going to be given an opportunity to simply and easily lift off from your tax base and go fly over to some other tax base. You know, governments need to control the population, and that's good, you know. But it is possible for individuals to build flying devices that will be transatmospheric and conventionally powered, and yet develop electrical attributes that enable the craft to be propelled from the Earth easily. And I want to add this. I want to talk in terms of the trash heap of this planet's surface, which is all stardust. Every element here that's greater than, like, carbon or maybe a couple of elements above that have come from the other stars, from the other galaxies. Dust has drifted in there and has collected to this ball here in space. Now, if you have a bowling ball and you put it out there at your house, maybe you put it polish it up really good and put it on the kitchen floor and leave it alone, it won't be long until it's you'll find it's covered with dust. And I think that's the way it is, pertaining to shape and the flow of the so-called electrons and protons and neutrons and mesons and quarks and all that stuff. According to their motions, they cause a predominantly positive effect, and negatively charged things attract to it. So I believe that the surface of the Earth is not really neutral, but rather it is quite highly charged negatively. Our local scientists would say, well, your kitchen table is neutral. Here, I'll connect this meter, one terminal of this meter, to the kitchen table and the other to a water pipe, and sure enough, the meter doesn't move, so it's neutral. But I believe the fact is that not only is the kitchen table electron-rich, but so is the water pipe and the ground and the ocean, and everything may be for a mile deep or maybe 100 or maybe 1,000 miles deep. And that on the deeper in the planet, that the elements are different, and that what we think of light here is heavy down there, and vice versa. Because, hey, look, we have, you're a gold miner, how is it that gold, which is one of the heaviest metals, can comes up into the mountains? And how do all these heavy elements come up? Well, it's because, I believe, that they are light when they're down in that positively charged area of the planet, and that there's a turbulent ever-going war interface takes place someplace down below, and there's this these elements come up, and then they're encumbered by electrons to finally the point where they behave like the elements that we see here. Well, boy, have I gone off track here, but it seems in my mind seems to be all perfectly connected.
Well, you know, having you as more of a scientist is a little unique for my audience. So many of the people that listen to the show feel that we're definitely in contact with extraterrestrials, and we're seeing displays occurring on a regular basis of UFOs and otherworld craft occurring. What's your take on that, Tom?
Well, I couldn't deny any of it. The other one of my realities is I call it tell us, feel us, smell us, taste us, vision land. I had a vision. I had a dream one day. I went to sleep on my couch in a very awkward position. And I woke up in the dream, and I was on a ski lift up at Mammoth, and it was one of these three-person wide chairlifts. And I was seeing an extreme fundamentalist on my right and a scientist on the left, an anthropologist, I guess. One of these guys, the guy on the left was saying, man, this planet's millions and billions of years old, and they found these bones and this and that, and the dinosaurs did this, and this thing came, and the other guy on the right is going, no, man. He says, no, God created man in 7 days, and there's only 5,000 years old, and all this fundamental stuff. And I'm going up the hill. It's a beautiful day. I can see the clouds, and I see other skiers, and I see the I'm cold, and I feel the snow. And then I wake up. And at no time did I imagine that I was asleep on my couch in an awkward position. So when some scientist says this or some fundamentalist says that on this planet, as far as I'm concerned, we're in a very clear and very consistent dream wherein we wake up every day and it's pretty much like the day before. However, I believe that we are on some level, and I take a page from when you and I both met at the Church of Scientology, which is not really a church, but it's a very interesting place. They talk about the eighth dynamic and the seventh dynamic. And in L. Ron Hubbard's writings, he says something like, hey, God, we don't know about that stuff. That's way beyond us. Let's just talk about man and what we can deal with.
Yeah.
And so in my reality, as far as the ultimate, and again, as soon as one assigns words like being or creator or any of these materialized language pieces, why it cheapens a relationship. Like somebody says, do you believe in God? And ask me if I believe in God. To say yes, it would cheapen the relationship intellectually. You know.
Yeah.
But anyhow,
are
in the days of old, they didn't have the language to talk about how the phenomena worked, other than fathers, sons, candles, bushels, goats, herders, you know. They couldn't talk about automation. It wasn't until Henry Ford's time that you could talk about something automatically happening. You couldn't say to a person in those days, hey man, you're just an automaton. It's just automatically happening. Monkey see, monkey do. You are picking up what you've seen and you're doing it, you know, automatically. Well, the earth and the workings have been described in different ways, and the language goes hand in hand, its progress, with the creation and development of things. The train, how to train your mind, it didn't come about until the train existed. Get on track, well, there has to be a track, and all this kind of stuff. Even the candle. These are devices. Well, today we have 3D movies, color movies. And I've got a flat screen color TV, and I could watch John Elway throw a football to some guy 70 yards, and my God, it looks like the ball's really going there, you know. And distances look real, and sounds are real, and somebody's already developed a way to produce aroma comes out of the TV. I cannot believe that there is not a good chance that we are the actors, directors, producers in an n-dimensional reality, which is feel it, tell it, taste it, smell it, vision, and that there are no distances. There is only the illusion, as the ancients talked about. But we've created it to such depth and such detail, and we've bought it to such extent that it's our reality here. And so that there are ancient, that there are other entities, other people on the center of the earth, people on other planets, alien activity out here. Sure, there's television, man. It's whatever the producers and directors, you know, whatever's produced. Whatever we'll buy, we'll buy.
Yeah. Well, you've had a lot of experiences in your life, and one of the things that we talked about the other night when we were getting ready for the show was the fact that you've been very active in the Baha'i Church, and that's an interesting religion. It certainly has a better world in mind, and you must have researched many religions before you made a choice of how you would interact with a religious organization. Tell us a little bit about your faith and what the Baha'is are doing in the world.
Thank you. Well, Christianity and Buddhism and Islam and the Book of Mormon, I've been on a long journey, Scientology, Maharishi's meditation. I've been a seeker. I am a seeker. And as I course through these pages, I found things that bothered me all along. And one of which is there was always a certain I'm better than you, I'm the boss, you don't need, don't ask that question, kind of attitude. Not that it came from various prophets, but it had developed over the years, so that there would always be some guy who was in charge. And anyhow, I came across I came across on the lawn on Kauai a really nice bunch of people that were having a picnic. There was a really attractive Hawaiian gal and a couple of young guys, surfer guys, and a black guy, and some, you know, and these were friends having a picnic. And as I walked by, they looked at me and they were open and courteous, and I was attracted to them. And as I talked with them, I liked them. And when they started to tell me about their religion, I was put off a little bit because I didn't really want to be in, I didn't think the world needed another guru, another, yet another teacher. You know. So this one gal, Bunny Gaines, said, well, I want you to come down to our store and I want you to, the way you talk and act, you're a Baha'i, and I want you to come read these things because I think you'll like them. Well, I remember in Christianity, the proverb, Jesus says that you'll know those who follow me by the fruits that they bear, and also that the sheep, when the sheep hear the voice of their master, they understand, they recognize it. So when I read the writings of Baha'u'llah, Baha'u'llah, which means the light of Allah, or light of God, or glory of God, which is a title which describes not a human being, but describes, I get this, it describes all of us. We all are as beams of the light of an unseen creator. And just as we can look at the sun, we never see the sun, we only see the light emanating from the sun. So it is that as we look around on the planet, we see the attributes of creation. And it is through our study, our worship, which really means the focus and concentration of thought, through the study of the reality, our common reality here, it is through that we get a glimmering of who, of, I can't say who or what, because that's all, again, lowering the relationship of God. So anyhow, I read the writings, the Baha'i writings, and they were written with great dignity and great clarity and poetic, and I took to them, and I took to the principles, and I could not turn them down. And I had a very hard time telling them to one of my more fundamentalist friends. In fact, all of my fundamentalist friends, they didn't want to hear this stuff, but for me it made total sense that mankind is one entity, one soul in many bodies, and that we are all equal in terms, in the eyes of God, that is, as well, like equally unequal. We're all creations, and that we need to work in our lives to eliminate backbiting, gossip, racial prejudice, prejudiced against the opposite sex, and similar impediments to us recognizing the oneness of mankind, that we are all one humanity, breathing in the same air. In fact, science tells us that we are, at this time, at this point, I'm probably breathing at least one molecule in this next breath of air that you might have expelled to breathe in at some other time. That we're recirculating the same air, the same water, the whole things are recirculating, ever-changing, turning inside out process, and we're all part of this. And man is not only one with himself, he's one with all nature and with all the other beings on this earth and on other planets. And Baha'u'llah in his writings talks about and he was in prison and in exile for some 40 years. He talks about the importance of going into all the churches and openly, with open heart, and consorting with peoples of all faiths and races, and encouraging whatever, doing whatever one can to encourage the unification of mankind, because with that we have our power. So I, after reading quite a lot and associating with these people for a while and loving them, I decided I want to be a Baha'i, and that was a huge step, you know, for me. Because it meant that I was advised as a Baha'i, I'm advised to avoid alcohol and narcotics, to not be promiscuous, and to apply myself to my arts and crafts and teach my children, try and ground my children in that which will enable them to provide for themselves and give them spiritual training, and then let polite learning take care of itself. But to enable individuals to support themselves and do what you can to encourage the an understanding of the different sides of the coin, science and religion, and that if something is supposedly so but is not understood, then either science hasn't figured it out yet or religion has degenerated to superstition. So with these kind of teachings, including another main teaching, Robert, is the progressive revelation that just as the sun rises gradually and sets gradually and nourishes on a daily basis all life kind, nothing happens. It doesn't happen suddenly. In reality, it comes up and grows gradually, and perhaps the little individuals that are on the mountaintops are aware of it, but those who are in the valley have no idea of it. But eventually, the light of the sun, physical sun, reaches through the day all the life forms. So do the teachings come on a periodic basis through greater persons of greater station. It doesn't mean this person's better than some other person, but just this guy happened to be coming along at the right time. Someone like Jesus, who was of a particularly sweet disposition and strong intellect, born at a raucous time in a troubled part of the world where life had degenerated to a great degree. Along he comes with a greater understanding and the ability and the charisma to bring it forth, and also a underlying belief in creation and the Creator, such that he was able to pray and fast and do what he did. You know, he prayed and fasted for 40 days, which is something that's not really talked much about. Baha'u'llah, Buddha, Krishna, Buddha, Zoroaster, these teachings are that from the beginning that has no beginning unto the end that has no end, manifestations of God will appear. Now, as soon as we add the words manifestations are given to man by God, or manifestations come to mankind, and all this stuff, it kind of clobbers up the concept. The concept really is that, as I get it from what I've read, and again, independent investigation of the truth is encouraged by the Baha'i. It's one of the Baha'i principles, along with not gossiping, you know, like that. Mm-hmm. Is that these greater revealers of God's word come every 600,000 years in dark times and enable us to see in a new way and to come closer, and that the cure for the ailments of the various ages differs, and that the sicknesses of today, the social sicknesses of today, require these social cures given by God for this day and age. Again, there I am, given by God, that cuts it down to argumentative.
Well,
okay.
Tom, we're coming up to a portion of the program where I just wanted to reintroduce you for just a minute or two, and then talk a little bit more about some of the great people you've worked with and some of the things that you've been involved in. Our guest tonight is Tom Morey. He's the inventor and the originator of the Morey Boogie Board. He's also been innovative in some other things. He's developed, I remember the Morey Fin, and I remember there was a line of Maury t-shirts, and you were part of the gang that were there on the beach when the Hobie Cat was developed, the Windsurfer. I remember Mike Quayle and the softboards and all of those great surfboards that people have all over the world enjoyed. So it's been quite an experience that you've used and you've given the planet all this fun, Tom. How's it feel to be about all this fun?
Well, it helps me realize that I am I'm okay. I'm not insane. A person has thoughts and tells other people their thoughts, and maybe they laugh or maybe they say that's good or whatever. But by having designed and developed a manufacturing process for and advertised and marketed a product that works and makes people happy, I know that I have worth, and my passion is to try and not squander that, because the sand of my clock's running out. You know, I'm 75 years old, and I'm left and right on my peers. And I want to be instrumental in the creation of a trans-atmospheric flying device that I built for my people, for myself and my friends, based on the principles that I've touched on and that are available to not even concentrated study, just from a decent study to the situation we're in and the materials that are available and the processes and the devices, and it's all in place. It's all in place for us to build the quality trans-atmospheric flying devices that are not fireplace technology, they're not rockets, but they are devices that are simply massive, probably metal, of which, by sound or other means, vibrational means, that the basic structure is turned to positive and is thereby repelled from the planet. And the reason I believe this is the way it's got to go is that you cannot find on the surface of the planet anything that has a strong positive charge. You can shuffle across the rug on a hot day and touch the doorknob, and you'll see that you have taken off some of the strong negative charges here. But the only thing that is positively charged to any degree are the fumes, I believe, from the fire, the fireballs that come as explosions take place and the gas ball rises at these high rates. I believe that why so many people smoke and smoke drugs, some of that has to do with the composition of the plant. But I believe a great deal of it has to do with the intake of the positively charged fumes. And I know from my own experience that I may be pretty luggy and tired and wiped out after maybe like a turkey dinner or something on Thanksgiving. And I'll go in the water and the cold makes me... And if you could photograph... Because photographs me at that point, you see this aura, this electron field developing from all the little hairs on the back of the neck and your arms and legs and all this. That there's an electrical outpouring which shocked off by a change, by a constriction, by a cold. And also, you might be not at all in the mood to converse and feeling like I just described. And go stand by a beach fire, and in a very short time, you'll feel yourself talking like a magpie, and your consciousness has switched to the elevated loving feeling for all these people, empathy for all these around you. And I believe that the positive charge is there all the time, but it's imprisoned by this vast electron cloud that is everything you touch and feel and smell and taste and see here is this electron cloud. Now, this doesn't have anything to do or line up at all with my previous theory, telepheel, smell, or taste division, but in here, we don't have to really have everything. We don't have to be real smart. We just have to go ahead and do some stuff and try and be good and nice and keep our dreams. But we can talk about a lot of things, and we need to talk more freely about everything. And we don't really have to keep a coherent chain. In English, you start on the left and you go to the right, and then you come back left, right, and go down the bottom of the page. But in reality, things come at you not left and right. They just come at you in their own time. And for the most part, the data that we pick up is coming at us in its own way, and we need to get more into picking it up as it comes. I do. Over.
Tom,
give me a lot of tolerance here, man. You have to talk about a lot of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'm trying to get a hold of Sherry now to see if we can play some of your music, Tom. And then after that, we're going to go into a portion of the program where I talk a little bit about some of the projects I'm involved in and what's going on in the world. Okay, I'm chatting with Sherry here. And, okay.
Hey, Robert, can you hear me now?
Yes. Can we play some of Tom's music?
Yeah, I was asking you if you could go ahead and play it. My internet is so lagging, I don't even want to touch anything on my screen right now. Can you play his song?
Okay, I don't know how to do it, Sherry.
You start playing. Pull up his song here, the file that he sent you.
Boy. Okay, I'd have to find it. Let me see if I can do that. We'll see what's going on here.
Arthur, I have two bars on my internet here, and I have Skype going and live stream, and I would just hate to lose it.
Okay. I'll see if I can find Tom's music. We've had an interesting evening tonight with Tom Morey. Tom's given us a perspective on how he feels a little bit about life, a little bit about his personal experiences on developing the boogie. Tom, again, how many people did you employ there where you had the factory in Oceanside producing the boogie?
Had about 60 people there.
Yeah, and that went on for quite a while until actually your production reached a point where you had to trying to keep up with inventory and keep everything going, you actually sold it to Kransko. And of course...
In order to make any money at this stuff, you know, when you're building a business, you never have any money. You're always buying more materials or hiring more people, and this goes on and on. So when we had a chance to sell, we could cash in a little bit. We got up to 1,000 boards a day. Kransko got up to 5,000 boards a day, making them in Tijuana.
Good heavens.
And we were making them, you know, every once in a while, some engineer would come in with some ideas for having a giant machine that would do all this, but we were doing this with knives and hot air guns and low-tech devices and craftsmanship. And
well,
really satisfying.
A lot of people sure enjoyed it back during that era. You had all the surfboards going. All the surf shops were carrying the boards.
It opened up new fields. It opened up new vistas of activity, too. They used to jump out of airplanes with parachutes. And one day somebody got the idea of taking his boogie board up there. He jumps out and he
puts
the boogie board down. And instead of having the glide ratio of a TIE fighter, he had twice as good glide ratio. And that segued into a young man, a Frenchman. I saw the video, a very exciting video of the first Frenchman that stepped out of an airplane with a surfboard strapped to his feet and stand up, surf the sky. God, was that cool.
Yeah.
And that went, that was good for a while, but then somebody figured out how to make it be double-ended like today's snowboard, and the snowboard had come about, so actually he stepped out with a snowboard and then could surf this way or that way or spin around and do all this other acrobatic stuff. But the boogie made it possible to go down streams, explore rivers, and then they took it into the bigger waves. A guy named Jack Lindholm, high school kid on Oahu, took one from the beach over there at Makapu, which is his home beach, Sandy Beach, and he went over to Bonsai Pipeline, developed a new way to surf it, which is one knee and ride pipeline in big waves. Well, my God, that just made the most exciting thing to see, because you fly like a streak. I had surfed a 15-foot surf over there at Sunset Beach, and you're just screaming like a skipping stone. You got no drag at all. And then the guys hanging around as they do that and doing aerial flips, flying up in the air and spinning all these different ways and dropping back in and getting barreled with a wave breaking over, completely and tunneling, encapsulating you for seconds, 5-10 seconds at a time. So it's been it's an exciting sport, still is to this day. Yeah.
You know, Tom, I apologize. I'm looking here for the music that you sent, and I really don't. Well, let's see here. Hang on. Maybe I do. Hard to say. No. I better not try it, Tom. I apologize. Go ahead and give everybody your website address and how they can reach Tom Morey music.
Our website is tommorey.com, and there's no music posted on it yet. And actually, we haven't touched it for 2 years. It's just I started writing some blogs and doing some things, and it just gets so complicated, and you get so many offhanded comments. And we haven't been commercializing and selling all these books.
Well, it's great music. It's jazz music and Tom.
The number you dialed is not a working number. Please check the number and dial again.
El número que marcó no está en servicio. Verifíquelo y márquelo de nuevo.
Message 3, CA3.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. Please enter your host PIN. When finished, press the pound key. The PIN you entered does not match the PIN you have on file for your account. Please re-enter your PIN.
Okay, Sherry, are you with me?
The PIN you entered does not match the PIN you have on file for your account. Please re-enter your PIN. Thank you for using Blog Talk Radio. Goodbye. Thank you for using Blog Talk Radio. Goodbye.
Okay, it looks like we're about ready to wrap it up. It's been an interesting evening tonight. We've had a lot of technical problems, but we still had Tom Morey on the show. I want to take this opportunity to thank Tom. Tom, are you still there? Looks like we've lost Tom. And I just want to say we'll continue to work on these technical problems, and thank you for tuning in. Hopefully, we're still streaming. And again, one of the things that we're looking at is the United States becoming more and more a third world country as we move further and further into the problems of an economy that's faltering. Again, I want to talk to all of you out there and talk about the importance of preparing yourself for a time when you may have to actually cope with survival situations. I recommend very, very highly that you go out and you begin to get yourself a food supply, begin to collect warm clothes as we face the winter. I know that up here where we are, the weather is beginning to change, and very soon we're going to have snow. So get yourself a good pair of shoes, keep your family close to you, begin to understand that the economy of the world is a brutal economy. It's an economy where people have to cope with the day-to-day survival that most Americans are not used to. Many of you have made investments, and you've seen those investments dwindle away. You've seen your Social Security checks get smaller without any increase. Are you beginning to understand that the future of the United States is one where we have to take control of our own lives, where we have to be ready to provide for ourselves, where we have to be, again, to provide for our family and to be able to go an extra step or two. So make sure that you're prepared for times that become even more challenging. It's a time when we learn to begin to go back to the basics of our lives, back to a time when we grew our own gardens, when we began to prepare our own foods, when we no longer lived out of a convenience store, back when it was more difficult, perhaps, to be able to find a way to take care of oneself. It's a time when 95% of the people in the United States live in the cities, when very, very few people actually have an inventory of food and stockpiles that they can draw upon. What will happen if all of a sudden the electricity's out? What will you do if your job is no longer there? What happens when suddenly you're confronted with credit card problems and the economics of how to maintain maybe not just one house, but two? Maybe it's a time when families will move in together. Maybe it's a time when basic values will come back, when we begin to realize that life is more basic, more like the people in other countries live. We've always had this advantage of being Americans. We've always had this feeling that it was going to be a good life. We had the idea that if we went to college and we got a good degree, that we would have a future. There would be jobs, and of course, every day we hear the politicians saying, well, it's things are going to get better, but they don't. They only get worse. So I think it's a time when we need to be independent. It's a time when we have to come to grips with a reality that is changing very, very quickly. If you've never gone to other countries, you may not realize that most people in other countries live day by day. And here in America, we're always planning for the future. We're always planning for how things are going to be when we get our degree or when we get that better job. So I think it's important that we realize that unless we move into a wartime economy, which has always been the solution that the politicians and the military has thrust upon us. And again, that takes us back to War Day. It takes us back to this period of time that we're now confronted with, when there's so much tension behind the scenes in the Middle East. And I'm very, very certain that we will come through it as individuals, although we may have to strengthen our resolve in order to do it. I know in my own life that's certainly happening with me. So I appreciate you tuning into the program, and I look forward to doing a lot more shows. I apologize for the technical problems we've had this evening. For those of you that have listened to my regular news update on the Paranormal Network, I want to thank Joe and the Paranormal Network and my staff, especially Sherry Fox, who's my executive producer, and also Leslie Mitz, who's my investigative reporter. I want to thank Jamie out there and his help and support, and all the individuals that have contributed to the making of my motion pictures and the interviews that they've given me. We had a great time in Roswell this year. I've got a lot of material, a lot of programs I'm in. So I invite you to check out some of the products that we're beginning to put on the site. There will be screenplays and the e-books, and also, of course, we'll be doing regular internet updates. So as we move forward, Sherry, how much time do we have left on the show? I'm hoping that we've still got Sherry there, and let me check there. You still there, Sherry? I know we're still streaming on the Paranormal Network, and this has been a time when Tom Morey has given us his views, and it's interesting because Tom not only is an astounding individual on a personal level, but also an amazing guy who not only created the boogie and the Morey fin and softboards, but he also had wave pools. And I know that even though Tom says he's 75, he's probably going to come up with a whole lot of new innovations. So as we move forward here, I wished I could have played some of Tom's music. Be sure and check out TomMorey.com, and please stay tuned for all of the developments that will be occurring here with the Safe Space News Agency. It's been an exciting and interesting experience to develop this television and audio network. And I want to thank Dean Thomas and all of the individuals that have contributed to that. Okay, it looks like I'm getting Sherry back. Maybe we can... No, I'm not sure. It's going to be a period of time for us as we begin to build up the program. I'm going to be putting a lot of information on there about gold. For those of you that are interested in gold mining and the possibility of, even of income, I've had the fortune to work with Dave McCracken, who's one of the foremost gold miners in the world. And for those of you that have never mined gold before, there's still a lot of gold left here in the United States. And generally, that's done by suction dredging. So if you're interested in gold mining, check out the New 49ers. Also, I'll have a lot of information on that for you on the website. So one of the things that I want you to do is, if you can, check out Roswell Revelations and Beyond, the trailer. There's also a 10-minute segment that we're playing there on the internet. On the network, you're going to find that there's actually about 6 different channels. And for those of you that enjoy the classic movies, they're there. Oh, I'm getting a message from Sherry. We'll see what it has to say. Yeah, kind of. So we're still struggling with it. Sherry had just recently moved, and she's getting her internet installed even as we speak at her new house there in Texas. So we're coming up on the end of the hour. And I want to, again, give my thanks to everybody that's been involved, especially Tom Morey, for being our guest this evening. And I invite you to stay tuned for the next shows as we move forward in the future. We're going to be playing a lot of the interviews that I've done, and I want you guys to all check out Open Files, which is a series of DVDs that we produced that give you a chance to get a longer, in-depth interview from some of the people that appeared in Fast Walkers. So there's four volumes currently out, and we will have a special running on the website. Check out our product store, and we look forward to being with you again in the near future. So I'm going to check here with Sherry and see how much time we have left on the show. This is very unusual not to have my executive producer with me. How much time left, Sherry? Let's see if she may not even be able to come online. Okay, 2 minutes. So looks like it's a wrap for the evening. Thank you for tuning in, and hopefully by the time we have our next show, we're going to have a lot of these internet problems worked out, and it's going to be a series of interesting and exciting guests, and we'll be putting together a group of individuals who can bring you diverse and different perspectives. Many of you out there are well experienced with the UFO and the ET field, and also many of you are interested in the economy and politics. I want to tell you that we live in exciting times. We are all challenged, and part of the challenge is just making this internet work for us, and please bear with us, and we look forward to being with you again in the near future. So I'm hoping that Sherry is going to give us a rollout. Do we have a rollout? Usually it's real unusual to just be here with you alone. And that's it.